you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynica Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's daily, newly designed China Access newsletter to keep on top of all the latest news from China from hundreds of different news sources. Or check out all the original writing on our website at subchina.com. We've got reported stories, essays and editorials, great explainers and trackers, regular columns, and of course, a growing library of podcasts. We cover everything from China's fraught foreign relations to its ingenious entrepreneurs, from the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslim peoples in China's Xinjiang region, to China's travails as it wrestles with a surging wave of COVID-19. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We cover China with neither fear nor favor. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. A couple of weeks ago on this program, my guests Yun Sun and Paul here joined me in sketching out some possible scenarios for the kind of world that that China, the U.S., and really everyone will be looking at when the smoke finally clears and this terrible war comes, as sooner or later it must, to an end. That was all done in kind of ad hoc manner, but in the time since, I've been giving that exercise a little bit of thought. And if, in keeping with the classic scenario planning practice, as I learned it, we're obliged to boil down and radically oversimplify all the uncertainties we're facing into just an X and a Y axis, then it makes sense to me that one axis should be geopolitical and the other geoeconomic, either a more unipolar world or a more multipolar one in terms of the overall geopolitical shape of things, and either a more globalized world trending toward more integrated trade systems and data flows and tech standards and movements of people, or a more fissiparous, decoupled world, a more geoeconomically fragmented world. So right now, it's truly all up in the air. All four of these things feel possible, the scenarios that are generated. I think we can tell stories of how we got there depending on what happens with the war, on elections or selections in different countries, and other domestic political factors in key countries. And I think we can all imagine what these different scenarios might look like when viewed from various national capitals and from different ideological perches. Clearly, the way that the U.S.-China relationship and, of course, China's relationship with Russia play out in the next few months is going to determine a huge piece of this. We have made that a big part of the focus of recent shows. But there are obviously other important factors too, and in this and upcoming episodes, we will be looking at some of those. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by someone who can lend just a ton of perspective to at least two of the vital and consequential relationships that China is attempting to navigate, relationships that remain very much in flux and have not assumed anything like, you know, a final shape. So Marina Rudyak is assistant professor in Chinese studies at the University of Heidelberg with an interim professorship appointment at Goethe University in Frankfurt in political science as well. Her research focuses on China and international development, but she also works on Sino-European relations and much more. So obviously she's someone who can speak to both the important China-Europe piece of the overall picture, which is something we have so far really neglected, and to the China and the Global South piece of it, which is really important and also something we haven't delved into quite enough. But her breadth of insight on China, on Russia, and the war in Ukraine derives also from her personal biography. Indeed, that matters a great deal here, as you'll see when I ask her to talk about it, which I hope she'll do just after I welcome her. So, Marina, a very warm welcome to Seneca.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Kaiser. It's a pleasure to join you, especially because I am such a huge fan of the podcast. So I'm really honored by the invitation. And yeah, thank you once again.
Entirely our pleasure. Great. It's just wonderful to have you. And also a big shout out to my friend Nason at the University of Pennsylvania for recommending that I reach out to you. He was absolutely right. So tell us about your fascinating family background and how you ended up in a China-focused academic career.
Ooh, yeah. So I am originally from Moscow, and what, you know, you could call a typical child of a very typical Russian academics or Soviet academics. So I was born in Moscow, and in 1991, we went to Germany for 1 year because my father is a mathematics professor. Then he was invited to Heidelberg for a year, and we left, and the Soviet Union collapsed. And like many, many Russian scientists at the time who were outside of this former Soviet Union, we stayed. So we went for a year, never went back. And this is how I happened to grow up in Germany. So how I ended up in China studies was by sheer coincidence, and not that an interesting story. But what became very, you know, very interesting part is that quite quickly I got interested in the political ideology of the Chinese Communist Party. Only much, much later I understood how this actually related to my family history, because my grandfather was a historian at the Institute of Marxism-Leninism, which was also the central archive of the Soviet Communist Party. And I grew up surrounded by books about, you know, Friedrich Engels and Karl Marx, back then not really understanding what it was about, but somehow it instilled me with an understanding and with a feel for ideology and the Communist Party, and probably also, you know, the early years in primary school in the Soviet Union, you know, being bombarded by all this, you know, ideological concepts you were back then as a child.
Yeah. So, Marina, when I said that you could lend perspective to at least two of the relationships, what I initially had in mind, of course, was first China in Europe, which is, you know, one area of your specialization. And second, China and the Global South, which is, of course, another topic you focus on. You do a lot of work on China's development initiatives, including, but I suppose not limited to the BRI. But I actually wanted to start with another one of these core issues, the China-Russia relationship. And this is something, as I've said, that we've covered quite a bit on earlier shows since February 24th. But when we were chatting earlier, you actually took some issue with an idea that seems almost to become conventional wisdom, this idea that somehow we can discount, if not entirely ignore, potential frictions between Moscow and Beijing over their long border and their overlapping interests in Central Asia. I mean, I think about how much skepticism there was about the Sino-Soviet split back in the late 1950s, and even after it actually happened in 1960, there were a lot of Americans in the intelligence community who were deeply skeptical, who didn't believe that these two ideologically compatible countries could possibly have such, you know, a schism. But anyway, this idea now that Russia is perfectly at ease with China building so much vital infrastructure in countries that used to be, you know, just 30 years ago, part of the Soviet Union, that strikes me also as maybe, anyway, you are somebody who has spent a lot of time in Central Asia. I think you spent some years of your childhood in Bishkek, and your mom, I think you said, was originally from Tashkent when we were talking earlier. So you see things differently from what some of our other guests may have said. So is the potential for tension, for dispute, or even conflict greater than appears to be commonly believed?
Well, I think and feel that there is a lot of potential for dispute. And it's not just the potential for conflict. The conflict is there, but the topic is so sensitive that everybody refuses to touch it. It's your classical elephant in the room. And it's so sensitive, you know, to the extent that nobody even dares to drop a word about it. And I remember so long time ago when I wrote my master thesis on China's energy security policy in Central Asia, I tried to find any evidence of potential conflicts, also because I spent 6 months in Bishkek during my university time, my interning with GIZ, which is the German aid agency, where, you know, the potential conflict between China and Russia just was so tangibly present. And what surprised me that neither in the Russian discourse nor in the Chinese discourse, and I talk about the written discourse, could I find any substantial traces. And this was just so suspiciously absent that you can think, you know, that the topic is so sensitive, nobody dares to talk about. And just from having spent time both in Central Asia, still being pretty much connected to Russia and also to a certain extent to Russian politics, and having lived in China for almost longer than 5 years, but having worked probably as close to Chinese politics as you can as a foreigner, the feel that I get is that, of course, there is a big conflict. And I think this is, you know, indeed, as you said, a big misunderstanding when you look at it from the West, because it appears so obvious that, you know, they would be ideologically aligned. But the truth is, and we have probably enough historical evidence for that, that Mao actually never trusted Stalin. And some archival research I did for my doctoral dissertation of Chinese foreign aid, I came across sources that argue that actually China was forced by Stalin to stay involved in the Korean War under the threat that if China, you know, withdraws, all the Soviet aid will be stopped. So it was not a love relationship to begin with, and it never developed into one, not even till today.
Fascinating. That's fascinating. I think it's worth remarking that I am a believer in this kind of intangible ability of some people just to have, like you said, a feeling for a country or for its people. I mean, I think it does make a difference. And, you know, even, you know, in the face of seemingly contradictory empirical data, or in your case, in the absence of any discussion, I think you can still sometimes read into that absence a real significance. So I do value it. I think it makes a huge difference when it comes to empathy, to national psychology, to understanding, you know, the semiotics and political communication and much else. This is actually a topic I hope to explore in another podcast in a series that I want to get back to. So I would love your thoughts on this, on, you know, because I think there are a lot of people in this data-driven world of ours who would challenge this idea that you can just sort of have a feel for, that, you know, they would say that, you know, doesn't this just boil down to essentialism? Do your claims to have special insight into the culture, do they evaporate in the face of actual empiricism? And I'm somebody who very much values the feel as much as I respect the data. Where do you come down on this? And have you encountered pushback on this idea before?
Like, first of all, as social scientists, we of course know that the answer substantially depends on the question we ask. And no good social scientist will deny that. At the same time, you know, what we call, you know, when we talk about feeling, it's not something, well, who is esoteric and tangible we talked about, but it's rather kind of, it's an intuition, and psychologists know that intuition is in fact, you know, neural pathways that have built through experience and experience and experience, and just through observation. So I think, and everybody who spent a substantial time in another culture will know that being in the field leads you to ask a different set of questions. And as somebody who's been very long in the region, you know, and who saw the tensions, you know, there is not much trust towards China in Russia. There is huge xenophobia in Central Asia. There is also not much trust towards Russia in China. I mean, there is enough evidence for that. And then if you take the step and ask, okay, if we see tensions on the ground, there must be evidence for them somewhere in the sources. And then you go into the sources and you see nothing, just nothing. This is proof. If something is absent, this is a proof too. So for me, you know, when I talk about the feeling, this is nothing, you know, esoteric. It's just kind of the set of questions that emerge in me, and where the questions come is experience. And I am aware of the argument colleagues make that they didn't find evidence for the tensions. But if you put all the puzzles on the table, maybe in the sense of Bruno Latour's actor network theory, where he argues, you know, you really need to map out everything. And then you will see that some pieces are missing. And yeah. This helps you to ask questions and to answer questions. In this case, if you map it out, some pieces are so visibly missing that it leaves you no other possibility than there is a tension nobody talks about.
That's right. In this case, the evidence of absence trumps the absence of evidence.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's the dog that didn't bark and how significant that dog is. Yeah, I think that's fascinating. Before we go on to talk about China's diplomatic efforts with Europe and other things, I want to get your take on where you see China more broadly on Russia and Ukraine right now, just building on what we've just talked about. I think a lot of people are having trouble getting a sense for, you know, how firm Chinese commitments to Russia are, really, in light of especially what some of its diplomats have said and done. Ambassador Qin Gang saying, for example, on an American television news show that despite China's friendship with Russia supposedly having no limits, it does have boundaries or it does have a bottom line. And then the latest example, we had, you know, Zhang Jun, who's China's UN ambassador, remarking at a UN Security Council briefing on Ukraine on April 5th. Today, by the way, is April 14th. He called the photos of killings of civilians in Bucha deeply disturbing, and he seemed to indicate support for an investigation into what led to the killings. He didn't call out directly Russia for this. But anyway, is all of this just PR? Or can we read anything into these sorts of statements, is your sense?
My sense is that on Ukraine, China has tried to walk a fine line, or if you call it a little bit more directly, to muddle through. Something that we've seen in many other contexts, because in the end, China is always on one side, and this is the side of China. And what we can see that kind of China tried to have the cake and eat it in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
So to keep the partnership with Russia, which is important at, you know, at the moment, given the state of the China-US relations, you know, to keep, you know, the economic relations with the EU, you know, as good as possible. And we saw, you know, the outcome of that at the EU-China summit, which, as Joseph...
We'll get to that, yeah.
It has, towards Ukraine, Chinese officials tried to be as supportive as it gets. So basically, China tried, in a way, not to step on anybody's feet for the sake of its own interests. And of course, in the situation as it is now, it's not working. And it is quite likely that China underestimated Putin. For certainly, it underestimated the Ukrainians. But in that, I think everybody underestimated the Ukrainians. So China is not better or worse off on that than anybody else. And it seems, you know, it seems to be a nightmare. You know, Chinese officials have been hoping it's going to go away, but it's not.
Indeed. So you mentioned EU and relations with the EU, which is, of course, one of the central topics that I want to discuss. What has gone so wrong for Beijing on that front? But before we get to that central question, which I think you have a lot to say about, I want to build up to this. So maybe bear with me while we lay a little bit of groundwork here. So I can't remember who it was that first raised this idea with me in conversation. I think it might have been either John Holden or Robert Daly. As soon as I heard it, I recognized there's a lot of truth in it. And that is this, that for an American who works on China, looking at the European relationship with China is very illuminating because you can examine important issues like trade, like technology, like human rights, without viewing them all through the lens of national security, something which is totally inescapable, unfortunately, in the American discourse. This is the case also, like, for example, with Australia, right? In the case of Europe, though, Beijing doesn't reflexively answer any criticism with, you know, this familiar allegation of hypocrisy of, you know, whether you think that these reflexive answers are genuine skepticism over America's moral standing or if it's just mere whataboutism. The foreign ministry or the state routinely does this with American critiques, like immediately turns it around. But so two questions. First, to what extent do you think that, well, first of all, that this is true, what I'm suggesting. And second, do you think that this is changing now when it comes to Europe? I mean, my worry is that it is changing. I wonder whether these issues are also becoming sort of securitized in the European mind more in more recent years.
So I think, first of all, you are correct in the sense that there are certain differences between the EU and US in terms of to what extent topics are linked to the issue of national security. And I would say that the EU, just being this multi-state construct, which is very diverse internally, we see it a lot, you know, that the EU can't agree on many issues due to its diversity. But because of that, I think the EU has a much higher tolerance for ambiguity than we see in the United States. And it certainly has a different stance on the issue of national security. And this became apparent to me actually in 2004. So my father works at the UF and has been in the US for many years. And I remember I visited him in 2004. It was just before the invasion of Iraq. And I was walking around on the campus and I talked to students who were kind of organizing something in favor of the war. And I asked them, you know, why are you in favor? Why do you believe that there are weapons of mass destruction? And said, well, first of all, it seems plausible, and we are afraid of Iraq. And for me as a European, this was so difficult to understand because just geographically, we are so much closer than the United States. And I don't know if it's fair to say this, that certain national security assessments in Europe are maybe a little bit more realistic, or honest. I'm not sure, you know, this would be a very far cry to say this. But there certainly is, you know, at very different levels for ambiguity and therefore probably a higher readiness to accept a multi-track and multi-level approach, which would be, yes, criticize China on human rights, but at the same time continue to trade. But as you said rightly, the situation is shifting at the moment. And this has certainly to do with Xinjiang. This has certainly to do with the overall change of climate in China, which is hurting European companies. It has also certainly to do with the 2 years of pandemic and the inability to travel, because the personal exchanges are not there, you know, the right. Conversations in between are not there. And what we are left, for the most part, except for those of us, obviously, who work on the subject, is the official propaganda on the Chinese side, like, you know, the Global Times, English newspapers. and also the Chinese stakeholders are very limited in their contact to Europeans. So we end up with the images of each other being based on projections and not on real interactions.
Yeah, that's so well said. And I mean, the example of these students in Florida supporting the Iraq war, in contrast to students maybe in Heidelberg, just who were a whole lot geographically closer to Iraq itself and, you know, also part of NATO, also part of the West, not feeling that security threat. Yeah, that's very instructive. So let's talk a little bit about what China's foreign policy goals are with respect to Europe. I mean, it to me has seemed always to be quite straightforward and obvious. I mean, first, it seems to me that China would like Europe to have a kind of strategic autonomy so that Europe, you know, eventually at least will exist as a separate pole in a genuinely multipolar world with its quite distinct, quite independent interests, quite apart from those of the United States. And so far, they have tried wherever possible to you know, kind of exploit and to exacerbate whatever differences there are between the U.S. and Europe. And second, and I think for the most part, Beijing, this is true of all sort of arrangements, whether we're talking about, you know, ASEAN or anything else, they would rather deal with countries individually rather than collectively. Yeah, and the reasons are pretty obvious. So that drives a lot of their behavior. If those are the goals, and do tell me if you think I've gotten this wrong, but it's got to be clear to Beijing right now in April of 2022 that things are moving in entirely the wrong direction. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has driven the EU and the US much closer together. And as far as European unity, well, look at the European Council vote on Russian sanctions when the invasion started. Right? I mean, it was unanimous, and this signifies an unprecedented level of cohesiveness. And to top it all off, I mean, as we were talking about, there's just all this increasing suspicion and distrust toward China. What has Beijing failed fundamentally to understand about Europe? Or have they maybe fallen under the spell of the, well, admittedly very formidable, discursive power of the American media? What are they getting wrong? Big question, I know.
Yes, it is a big question. Well, first of all, I think the biggest part China probably got wrong is to believe that for Europe, economics and trade will go above everything forever. And this is certainly not the case. For me, it was really surprising, looking at the EU-China summit, just how wrong apparently China got the EU. When the European agenda was to talk about Ukraine and to talk actually about human rights, and the Chinese side, wanted to talk about more positive things, up to the point that I don't know it was intentional or not, that the Chinese state media published Xi Jinping's remarks on the summit, which were very much trade focused and focused on that the EU needs a strategic autonomy and so on and so forth. So published it in the middle of the summit, before the summit was even finished. And I think what China substantially underestimated is that, China is not the only country that is ready to eat bitterness. And this is something, the Chinese believed that Europe will swallow certain things to keep the trade relations going. And this is, by the way, a blind spot I see not only in China, but actually at the same time in Russia and in Europe and in the United States, that everyone believes that they are the only one who care about values. It's kind of the Americans thought that the trade war would change something among Chinese people. The Americans and the Europeans collectively thought that imposing sanctions on Russia will lead to the Russian population to revolt against Putin. Certainly not the case. I mean, if we know something about, I'm exaggerating about Russia, it's that people really can suffer and are ready to suffer for ideas, ideology, and the Tsar. And it's also like Russia underestimated that the Europeans will be ready to have an economic downturn for values. And the Chinese have underestimated that. And this surprises me really how this can be such a collective blind spot.
That's amazing. I mean, you're completely right. You're right. Everyone thinks that they're the only principled actor, that they actually do hew to their values, and everyone else is actually ultimately motivated by money. See, I when you put it that way, it makes absolute sense to me. I mean, I had always sort of thought maybe China was particularly susceptible to it because of the Marxism-Leninism, this idea that, everything else is superstructure, that the real structure is the economic, is the relations of production. And I mean, I, for example, when China's response to what was happening in Hong Kong always was some variation of, if we solve the housing situation, if there were more affordable housing for people, then nobody would be in the streets opposing this extradition bill. This is just a result of economic dislocation. Huh. But, you're right. I mean, I wonder, though, I mean, if Americans really will trickle and suffer for when it... I don't know. We'll see how long we can take this. Oh, my God, $4 a gallon gasoline. So what will, in fact, Europeans' reactions to, say, being starved of natural gas and oil from Russia, what will, in fact, the response be? Will they just pay more at the pump and suck it up? Or what are they going to do?
Yeah, this is a very, very important point you're raising. And also something I feel China has underestimated, again, which surprises me given China's own transition trajectory. The whole debate about decoupling from Russian coal oil and gas, of course, doesn't land in an empty space, but it lands in the space of a debate that has been ongoing for the past 16 years, basically throughout the whole reign of Angela Merkel, where the Greens and also to a certain extent the Social Democrats have been trying to push for economic transition toward more carbon neutrality, which has been extremely difficult because of the interests of the German industry, which of course relies on fossil fuels. I mean, we are, in German, we say we are kind of the export champion, export Weltmeister. So all of that needs to be fueled by something. And at the same time, I mean, everybody understands that this is a transition that needs to happen, both for climate change reason, but also to reduce dependence on countries with whom there is potential of conflict.
Right.
So what we see now is an opportunity to speed up this development and to push against, not only to push against interests that prevented the transition, but actually the opportunity to get them on the side of the reformers, because the costs of non-reforming, the costs of staying reliant on Russian oil and gas are too high, not only economically, but also just in terms of security and also public opinion.
This is an opportunity to win conservatives to this side as well.
Exactly.
Because these are things that appeal to them,
exactly.
Economic and national security arguments.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's you're right. This is another blind spot. This is what Americans say. They make lemonade when given lemons. Right? So I'm curious. Let's talk a little bit more about April 1st and the summit meeting between the EU and China. Of course, the EU's foreign affairs chief, as you said, Josep Borrell, called it a dialogue of the deaf. He used a phrase that might have gotten him, you know, Twitter mobbed here in the U.S., but I guess he couldn't resist that alliteration. Anyway, as far as I can tell, his characterization of it, whether politically correct or not, was not far off at all. What was China actually hoping for? I mean, did they think that they would make progress in getting the investment agreement unstuck? Did they think that they could avoid somehow having this difficult conversation about Russia and Ukraine? I wonder what Europe's expectations of Chinese behavior would be. I mean, did they think somehow that they would come out of it having convinced China to abandon Russia? I mean, it seems like maybe expectations on both sides seem to have been unrealistic.
Well, I think on the European side, the summit was, you know, perceived as a, certainly being a very difficult one from the mm-hmm, start, mm-hmm. And there were not many expectations of success, but there was an expectation to have a dialogue and to talk with China on Ukraine, and of course to try and persuade China to take a stance, even if, you know, to give it a try. Now, on the Chinese side, of course, we know that the Communist Party is a black box, but I mean, this is a really interesting question. And to me, the leadership, or at least what we see of the Chinese leadership at the moment, seems to be unusually disconnected from what is going on in Europe. And this is really surprising, because China, of course, does have Europe experts, but either it is that they are not in the environment, in the surroundings of Xi Jinping, or that, you know, he doesn't have people who talk truth to him, which would not be surprising, you know, if we remember the outcome of the elections in Taiwan, where, you know, he was completely surprised. You know, because nobody have told them about the reality of the polls, obviously. Or whether it's, you know, again, the 2 years of isolation, Xi Jinping himself not having traveled, being, you know, very little exchange between European and Chinese actors. But I think what the Chinese leadership has underestimated is just the shared awareness among European leaders about the situation on Ukraine, which was certainly co-created by how Ukrainian President Zelensky is holding himself in this situation. And this phone call, video phone call with the European Council, where he said, you know, this may be the last time, you know, you see me talking to you, because, you know, I'm staying here in the conflict. He refused to be flown out. And I think, you know, this did something. And the images coming of Ukraine are doing something. So I think China really underestimated this power of shared awareness, and it also underestimated just the power of the civil society transnationally, you know, being the civil society in Ukraine that stayed to fight, civil society in Europe that is protesting and organizing help for Ukrainian refugees or, you know, bringing things to the borders, civil society in Russia, you know, trying to protest despite huge personal dangers. You know, people ending up in prison for 15 years just for, say, naming this war a war. Even civil society in China, I mean, we've seen Chinese netizens discussing Bucha and comparing it to the Nanjing massacre and, you know, bombarding denialists and, you know, government bots telling them, you know, would you also deny the Nanjing massacre if you denied the authenticity of these images? And I think all of that is something the Chinese leadership underestimated because it's so disconnected from what's going on in the rest of the world and disconnected physically, you know, just because due to the lack of like really people-to-people exchange.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of everything that you've just said, that there's an element of, you know, seize isolation from people who would speak the truth. But, you know, you talk to these European experts in China. Do they themselves have a clearer idea? Do you sense that they're also deluded or that they have a good picture, a realistic picture, and just simply aren't getting through?
Well, those people I talk to, I would say, have a good picture, but they are not the ones who are getting through. They are the ones who are in danger of being silenced and have to walk a really fine line, you know, to stay in their jobs.
There's this notion that somehow, no matter how much opprobrium, no matter how the economic consequences play out, that somehow Xi will stand by Putin. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I still nurture hopes myself. I mean, I recognize that it's kind of far-fetched, but I have thought at various times that, you know, well, look, isn't it really the case that if you've got a super strong entrenched leader, that's the circumstance under which abrupt turns in foreign policy orientation actually can happen? Because, you know, he's kind of invulnerable. He won't have to pay a price for making a U-turn. He can just sort of say, you know, Eurasia has always been at war with Oceania, or, you know, just the 1984 style, just rewrite the truth of it. I also look at things like some of the things that you pointed out, the way that a lot of Chinese netizens have been very, very critical. And I almost sense that this discursive space in China is opening up a little bit. And the other thing I look at is just how incredibly sensitive they are to public embarrassment over the levels of domestic support for Russia. So, you know, this whole kerfuffle over the Great Translation movement. And this is also, you know, when SubChina was attacked by the Global Times, it was also, they really hate it right now when any news organization or any Chinese netizen group tells the truth about some of the awful things that other Chinese are saying about the Ukraine conflict. If we embarrass them somehow by showing how much domestic support there is for Russia, I think that where does that embarrassment come from? Maybe somebody somewhere regards it as a constraint on their freedom of policy choice in a very fluid and very high-stakes situation. Like, they want to be able to change their minds on this, and we're not helping by pointing out, you know, what Chinese netizens are saying, some of the awful things, or that some of the things that are coming out of news organizations like the Global Times. Anyway, I realize that that's probably very far-fetched, and it's probably as locked in as most people say, but I wonder what you think about this.
Well, I think that, I mean, you're right, then they are trying to walk a very fine line, and walking the fine line includes not having, you know, the weight on one side or the other. I mean, what is certainly the case is that there are different voices even within the core leadership, and we see reflections of that. You know, even if we look at what Wang Yi is saying, you know, in support of Russian friendship, and what the Chinese ambassador to UN has been saying. So clearly, like, even despite, you know, this belief that Xi Jinping is the strong man, the question is how strong is he still? We see different voices coming out of China. This is one thing. The other thing is that we talked a little bit about Central Asia, and we should not forget that, God forbid, Russia is successful, Central Asia may very well be next. And this is certainly not in the Chinese interest, because I mean, China, as we know, China is massively invested in Central Asian oil and gas fields. We know that it has, you know, troops, you know, ready to cross the border should these fields be in danger. Something that has been built up after the Operation Desert Storm, when kind of they were a little bit shocked by what the Americans did in Kuwait, and certainly when there were protests in Kazakhstan recently, and Russia sent in troops very quickly. We didn't see a lot of reporting on the Chinese side, but you know, just putting one and one together, you could expect that the Chinese government was quite shocked.
We should remember how many Russian speakers there are especially in northern Kazakhstan.
Yes.
I mean, ethnic Russians themselves, but also Russian speakers. That seems to be sort of something that Putin uses as a determinant for the level of justifiable intervention, right?
So yes, Russian is still the common language. And, you know, children still travel to Moscow for for New Year's celebrations. You know, there is kind of tradition to have, you know, it's called the Christmas tree, basically, well, the New Year's tree, which is something very, very Soviet, where you have before a New Year's celebration, and there is one in the Kremlin, and, you know, the best school students of all over the country used to be invited. And still, you know, school children from Kazakhstan, from Kyrgyzstan, travel to Moscow for New Year, the best ones.
Wow.
So this culture
30 years later.
And I remember, like, when I was working in Kyrgyzstan, and I happened to cross the border between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan quite a few times by foot, they looked at my German passport, where it's written that I was born in Moscow, and say, oh, one of us, you know. So, and I think, and China is probably, you know, very well aware of that. They're aware that they don't really understand the region, but neither do they want it, you know, to become Russian again, nor do they want to have unrest there because of Xinjiang, obviously.
Of course.
And, you know, to come back, to your original point, where does China stand? I mean, China always stands on the side of China. And this supposed closeness to Russia at the moment is probably because there is no alternative. And I keep wondering, and, you know, just linking to what Susan Thornton said in her podcast with you, if the U.S. were to offer, you know, a diplomatic way out, maybe, you know, similar to what we had in, you know, after 68 under Nixon when Russia invaded Czechoslovakia, whether, you know, if China would have, you know, an improved relationship with the United States, where it would, you know, just, you know, drop Russia rather like a hot potato.
One can only hope. But right now, China feels like everywhere it turns, it sees evidence of stronger American alliance systems. You know, whether that's in the East, where you have not just the Quad, but also AUKUS, or obviously to the West, where you have a revived NATO. There is one cardinal direction where China can still turn and count on, at least so far, a pretty positive reception. You've been working for many years on China's role in development in the global South. So let's talk about China's global South strategy and European reactions to it specifically, not just BRI and the European response, this global gateway idea, but also, you know, the European reaction to China's role, if any, in providing cover for the countries of the global South that aren't completely on board with the European and American-led effort to diplomatically and economically isolate and strangle Russia. So let's talk about the vote to remove Russia from the Human Rights Council, for example. I thought that was really interesting, the number of, you know, what the way that the vote went and who abstained and who voted no in sort of solidarity and the reasons why they might have. It's fascinating to see. What did you make of that?
I think first of all, you know, I think it's really important to understand that for the global South, the war in Ukraine is the war of the West. And there is a very strong feeling just about the difference how refugees from the Middle East or, you know, from African countries have been treated in the past years in Europe and how differently the refugees from Ukraine are treated now. And even to the point that when African students tried to flee to Poland after the conflict escalated, they were stopped at the border. So the Polish, I'm not sure if it was the Polish or the Ukrainian border guards who basically didn't let them pass and said, you know, it's only Ukrainians who can leave. And I mean, this was a huge debate in social media. It sends a very, very strong message to the global south that, you know, this is your war. We are not part of it. So the abstaining is not necessarily because they agree with Russia. The abstaining is rather, you know, this is your war, you know, deal with your mess yourself.
Huh. That's interesting. What about the broader European response to China's efforts? I mean, do you think that they are in very close alignment right now? Does, you know, the fact that the Global Gateway seems to be kind of in alignment with B3W, with Build Back Better World, do you think we should read anything into that? Does this look like another Euro-American sort of entente to confront China in Africa?
Well, we see a number of initiatives, both from the European Union, from the United States, from the G7, you know, starting with the European Asia connectivity strategy.
Right.
And then there was the Blue Dot, then there was B3W, and then Global Gateway. And what all of them have in common, unfortunately, is that they seem to be more about solving the West's China problem than addressing the development challenges of the global south.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, to begin with, there was actually a wonderful podcast Dan Banik in Pursuit of Development did with Judy Moore, formerly Berian Minister of Public Works.
Judy is great.
He's amazing, right? Where he said, like, Europe is so close to Africa. Why did it take China to come and start developing the African infrastructure? Why is there no European infrastructure development plan for Africa? And he also compared the BRI with the US war on terror, stating that the BRI was, you know, estimated to be 1 billion, right? If I'm getting the English naming of the numbers correctly. And the war on terror was 6. So he said, like, if the US wanted, it could have had 6 infrastructure initiatives for Africa, or globally. So why did it take, you know, China to come first, and now kind of, you know, the West starts responding? And Hannah Ryder of Development Reimagined, she really, you know, carved this really nice phrase I like to borrow, is that we really need to change how we think about development. Development is not about them, you know, somewhere in Africa or in poor places. It's about us. And then until we start thinking of development as our problem, China will be in the lead, because, I mean, no matter what the real motives are behind, and I mean, the Africans understand everything very well, but China comes in with the story of a community of shared future for mankind and says, you know, we are doing development for you and for us. And then if you look at the Global Gateway, it's very fluffy, you know, European principles, but what is it? What is really the European interest? What is it that we really want to do there? This is not spelled out in the Global Gateway strategy. So this is like, when I was reading the document, I was like, okay, so what is it? What is our interest in Africa? What is it that we really want to do? Because the whole document is, yeah, whatever it's done should be according to our principles. But
what's the actual offer, right? Right.
Yes, what is the offer? What is our interest? Why do we want to develop infrastructure in Africa? And this is an answer we have to come up with, because...
Yeah, because the obvious answer that suggests itself is just that, well, we want to offer an alternative to China. That seems to be the reality of
it. And this is the wrong answer, which the answer should be not we want to offer an alternative to China. The answer should be we want you to develop, because if you're better off, all of us are better off. And Africa needs not Chinese or European money. Basically, you know, it needs all of the resources it can get.
I hope our listeners can hear those lovely church bells tolling in the background.
Yeah, I live in the old town.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So
I love it. No, it adds some real, you know, atmosphere to this conversation. But Marina, what an absolute pleasure to have you on the program, and I can't wait to have you back on again. There's obviously so many things that we can talk about together. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for the invitation. And it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, I'm not done with you yet because we have to move on to recommendations. I'm really excited to hear what yours is. But first, a quick reminder that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. If you like the work that we're doing and you want to help us to keep the lights on, you can subscribe to SubChina's China Access newsletter, which is curated for you each weekday by Jeremy and his crack team. You will dig it. If you aren't already subscribing, please do. While you're there, check out some of the other great newsletters we put out for free, like our SubChina AM business newsletter or our SubChina Vibe with Zhaoyun Feng puts together. It's all about society and culture in China. It comes out once a week. It's fantastic. Okay, so on to recommendations. Marina, what do you have for us?
So what do I have for you is, first of all, a book by Otto Scharmer. Mm-hmm. Who is a German organizational psychologist based in MIT. It's called Theory U, Leading from the Future as It Emerges. Hmm. It's original background, it's from organizational development, but it's been picked up by a number of organizations, actually including the UN. And this is about, management and collaboration methodology that prevents us collectively from recreating, and producing outcomes we collectively don't want. Sharma's basic assumption is that we still try to find solutions for problems we have created with the same methodology that has created them. Uh-huh. And at its core is a disconnect, from the self, from the environment around us, and in the end, also from the divine. And I find it really fascinating because it helps you really to break through blind spots that we have been talking about. And just very recently, he released a blog post where he used Theory U to analyze the Ukraine war and where he talked about the disconnect Putin had with the reality, also about the blind spots of the West, and a lot of my analysis of the Chinese leadership at the moment is informed by his perspectives. So even if it's not a China book, but a more broadly management and collaboration, it's hugely informed my research, and I can only recommend the book to anybody to start thinking how to resolve blind spots.
Sounds great. It sounds like very much in line with a lot of the books that I've been reading recently too. Theory U, Leading from the Future as It Emerges, Otto Scharmer. Wow, that's great. I'm definitely going to check that out. I have a couple, really technically three recommendations. The first two are both Fiona Hill related. I just read a piece in the New York Times Magazine about her, so that's one of my recommendations. It's by Robert Draper. It's really great. I don't remember what the piece is called, but it's about Fiona Hill. It's just a profile of her. And then because it's referenced in that piece, I bought the book There's Nothing For You Here, which is her autobiography, her memoir. Fiona Hill, of course, was the National Security Council Senior Director for Russia and Eastern Europe. And she was, of course, the key witness in the first Trump impeachment. Just a fantastic book so far. I was surprised to learn she's actually opposed to Bush's plans to extend NATO membership to Georgia and Ukraine. In 2008, the lead of that article by Draper starts with her in her first meeting in the Oval Office, and she made the case against NATO expansion to Bush and Cheney. And Cheney basically said to her, "So you're telling me you're opposed to freedom and democracy?" And he just sort of like got his things and left. And Bush says, "Oh, come on, he's just yanking your chain. Let me hear what you have to say." But anyway, he went ahead. He disregarded what she said anyway and plowed ahead with something like, an extension of NATO membership, enough to really piss off Putin. But I don't want to litigate that whole thing, but it's interesting that was her perspective. She had lots of other really tons of great anecdotes. I'm not, done with her book yet. Of course, I just started it, but so far it's been fascinating. She's a very good writer, very thoughtful, and obviously has a fascinating biography, which was part of her testimony. She grew up literally as the daughter of a coal miner in northeastern England, in the blighted industrial northeast. and made her way despite, you know, class and accent prejudices that are very deeply embedded in English society. She got a PhD from Harvard. It's a really good book so far. And so my other recommendation is a piece, it happens also to be in the New York Times Magazine, by Stephen Johnson, who is just one of my favorite writers on all things science. It's about GPT-3, which is a really advanced new AI system that is able to create original writing based on prompts that you give it in, you know, language, just natural language prompts. It's there's a ton of examples in this piece of little essays written by GPT-3 just based on prompts that Johnson fed it. It's scary and really quite nuanced the way he writes about it, and just really deeply informative. It's so good, so good. So look for that one, Stephen Johnson. It's called The Writing on the Wall, and it's in the New York Times Magazine. So check that out if you're interested in these things. Meanwhile, I can't wait to have you back on, Marina. This will be so great. I mean, I'm really glad to have met you, and I can obviously see that you are a good all-arounder and will so thoughtful and so many great ideas. So I look forward to having you back onto the program.
Thank you so much.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced and edited by me, Kaiser Guo. We would be delighted if you would drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com or just give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, as this really does help people discover the show. Meanwhile, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and be sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.